Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Shara Connor. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight on Speak On It. Before we begin, we would like to thank everyone who listened to our first podcast last Thursday as we interviewed Bernice Alexander Bennett. Shara Connor and I appreciate all of the kind expressions of support we received via text, phone calls, emails, and Facebook posts. Also, we'd like to thank you for the well wishes and kind greetings for Bernice. Shara Connor, I'm so excited to be here. What about you?
I am excited, and I'm looking forward to tonight's podcast.
Awesome. As shared last week, we are thankful for Bernice as she has graciously allowed us to provide a platform for future guests to share with you, our listeners. Tonight, we are so excited to welcome Dr. Flora Brown to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Shara Connor.
So a little bit about her bio. Dr. Flora Morris Brown is an author, publishing coach, and certified guided autobiography facilitator and trainer who confesses to being a reformed coffee snob and having an unhealthy love of British murder mysteries. She helps everyday people, even those insecure about their writing skills, write their life stories to pass on their experiences, values, and memories to their families to treasure now and as part of their unique legacy. Dr. Brown earned a BA, MS, and PhD from the University of Southern California. She enjoyed teaching junior high through university levels over a 40-year career, the last 20 of which were at Fullerton College, from which she retired as Professor Emeritus.
Drawing from the highlights of happiness research and her adventures as a wife, mom, and educator, Dr. Brown wrote the best-selling book, Color Your Life Happy, Create Your Unique Path, and claim the joy you deserve. Her most recently released book is Redesigning My Resilient Life, a guided journal for the pandemic, social unrest, and political turmoil. She invites you to visit her website, florabrown.com, to learn about her current programs, get free downloads, and discover how to connect with her on social media. I am so excited to meet you and introduce you, rather to have met you and to introduce you tonight and welcome you, Dr. Brown.
Thank you so much, Janice and Shara Connor, for having me here and giving me an opportunity to talk about life stories, because you know I love to talk about that.
So let's dive in with the first question. So we did do your bio, but can you share a little bit more about your background and who is Flora Brown?
I would be more than happy to do that. My life was shaped by the 1950s, 40s, 50s in a segregated part of St. Louis. And it made a big difference in my life because of the fact that we were segregated, as people know, means that you are living with other people, and not only living with, your shopping, your church, all of the things you do probably are within a very small, tight community. But that turned out to be a good thing for me, because the educators, the church leaders, all of the people who were the leaders in my during my upbringing, tended to be, many of them were highly educated, because had they been in a regular, quote unquote, regular time where they could have, applied for jobs anywhere and worked anywhere in the world, they weren't able to get jobs anywhere other than in a black community. So I grew up observing these highly educated people, which, you know, whet my appetite for education. And then my mom really had her feet in two camps. She loved music so much that She probably would have gone into being a musician for her career, but she was also very practical. So she opened a home-based beauty shop. So I grew up in a beauty shop where we lived in the back. Beauty shop was in the front. And that made a huge difference in my life because I grew up listening to stories. I grew up listening to the ladies talk about their lives and their hardships and the things going on with them. And then I also, of course, was going to a church where the people were very hardworking and had really worked hard to get their educations and to get the homes that they had. So I was observing them. And then my father used to take us to the movies every Saturday night of my childhood because my mother was always working on Saturdays until, you know, the end of the day. People were getting their hair done for Sunday, right? And so I grew up watching all of these, every movie that came out between the end of the 40s and till I hit teenage, we probably saw the major ones. And in the old days, when I was growing up, you saw a major, or actually you saw two feature films. You saw cartoons, you saw newsreels. You were at the movie theater for hours and hours. And those movies had a big influence on me too, because in the whereas I was growing up in a segregated community, in the movies I was seeing styles from all over, and that made me see things that I thought, oh, when I grow up, I want to have that, or I want to have that, and so that influenced me. And then the community was very active with things like the YWCA and YMCA. So I really had a great upbringing that really shaped my life and made me fall in love with reading, fall in love with school, and some great role models to and mentors to let me know that what I wanted to do in my life was quite doable. And I think that's what's right. important about seeing people that look like you. Then you know yes. that what you, your dreams are doable. And that was the great thing about that growing up experience.
That's excellent. And, you know, it's funny when you mention about growing up with the beauty salon, I thought about the superstar Beyonce because her mother was a beauty salon owner. And she talked a lot about, you know, the impact that had on her and her sister's life growing up in the beauty salon and listening to the stories of the women, you know, because that's a very, like, vulnerable kind of intimate space. And so you do, you're privy to a lot of, like, really interesting information. So.
You are. And I was going to say, what's funny about it is I'm a little older than Beyonce, but it may have been the same situation where children have right. To be seen and not heard. Remember that?
Right. Yes.
And so I could sit in the beauty shop or I could sit in the room right next to it and listen to my heart's content because they weren't paying that much attention to me as long as I didn't say anything. And I would get these scenarios in my head about, wow, I wonder why, you know, because women, the beautician was like a therapist. And
right.
not only a therapist, my mother was like a confidant. She was also a banker for some of the women who wanted to have her keep their money for fear their husbands would take it, you know, or their husbands would give them, what do you call it, a budget for groceries. Let's say if it was a housewife, they didn't have access to any other money than whatever their husbands gave them. So whatever amount they got for groceries, they would peel off a little bit of that and save it.
Wow.
My mother became their banker. And that way they felt better about their lives because they always had some money that they could
do things with.
Some
form of control.
Some form of control, yeah. So I would listen to all of this, and boy, I was formulating my life.
It
makes a big
difference.
Story
in of itself. Yeah, the whole idea of saving the money, I didn't know that. Fascinating. So that you kind of touched on the next question I had. But how did you become interested in storytelling?
Okay, the women would be sharing things about their lives, and then I discovered that books and magazines had stories in them. I don't even remember when I first learned to read. I just feel like I always could read. But,
always read.
but, you know, I just don't remember starting to read. I just remember reading. And what would happen at the beauty shop, women would bring things. Some of the women worked in white homes as, you know, doing maid work during the day. And they were always receiving things from their bosses. And so they were forever bringing books and magazines. And my father was always bringing from all the activities he was doing. He'd bring pencils. And I had a whole, somebody gave us a roll-top desk. I just remembered that. Wow. Somebody gave us a roll-top desk. It was too big to really be in the room it was in, but we put it in there anyway. And I had a great time pretending I was doing school or libraries, had all those little cubby holes. So I loved books and stories. And when I found out that books could transport you to other places mm-hmm. and you could learn mm-hmm. about people living in other countries, because we didn't have a television. Would you believe we didn't have a television?
Oh,
well,
wow.
Actually, TVs were just coming out in the late mm-hmm. 40s and 50s. And my mother was not an early adopter, okay? Whenever something new, because she was very budget conscious, she was not going to be the first one because all that stuff was extremely high when it would first come out. So, you know, we listened to radio and all those kind of things. But when I realized how great books were in taking you to other places, learning about encyclopedias, she bought a set of encyclopedias that were very expensive, you know, to her.
Remember that.
That was very important. Yeah, and that was a constant thing that we would look up things. It's like now we Google it, we would encyclopedia it.
Yeah.
And then when I started school, that was it. When I started school, I kept asking my mother, who are those kids passing by our window and what are they carrying? They're carrying books on their way to school. And I thought, oh, I want to go to school. And she said, don't worry, you'll get to go to school one day. So when I hit 4, I guess I must have decided it was time. She said, you aren't going to be able to go to school because the age was 5, I think you had to be. And I was like 4, 4 and a half. And I knew school was starting because summer was in, you know, the kids had been outside, you know, summer doing summer activities.
Right.
And now school is starting and they're walking past my house again going to school. So I kept bugging my mother so much that finally she said, look, they're not going to admit you, but I'll take you anyway so you can find out. My mother was not a pushover by any means. So for her to give in to take me to school to see if she could get me in, that meant I was really bugging her, right? And so she takes me to school, and we're in the kindergarten room, and the teacher is writing with this fountain pen, which as a little kid, I thought it was a hypodermic needle for giving you a shot. And I thought to myself, you know, we're waiting in line with all the others. And I thought, well, I have to get a shot. And then I thought to myself, I don't care. I'm willing to get a shot to go to school. And when we got up there to that desk, the teacher looked at I guess you had to have your birth certificate or whatever. She looked at it and she goes, I'm so sorry, she's not old enough. You'll have to bring her back next year. And you had to wait a whole year because, you know, they wouldn't take you half year in those days.
No.
And mm-hmm. when I was trying to follow the conversation between the teacher and my mother, right, and trying to see what was the verdict, and I'm listening to them, and finally I heard the part about she's going to have to wait till next year. Oh, my goodness. I had a conniption fit, as the kids would say. I had never had a tantrum. My mother wasn't the kind of person you pull tantrums on, okay?
Right.
I just lost it, and I started crying and going on. That teacher and my mother were just spellbound because they didn't know what to do because kids didn't act like that in those days, and especially I didn't. I was a well-behaved kid. That kindergarten teacher finally just decided if there was going to be any peace in the world again, she was going to have to do something. And so she said, okay, well, we'll let her come in and we'll try her, you know, and see if she's going to be able to keep up. And so we'll go ahead and admit her because I was 4 and a half, I think. Oh, my goodness. I stopped crying instantly. Haven't had a tantrum since. And I thought, this is fantastic. So I
Very
started
cool.
school, and I was so in love with school that I just, and we had a great library, thank God, because of the where we were located. It was kind of like the district library was attached to our school. So we had, I was always hauling books home. I fell in love with teaching so much that the teachers in those days, if you were well-behaved, the teacher would let one of the more mature acting kids sit at her desk while she went to the restroom. You know, people, you can't do that.
Right.
But so I was like the teacher's monitor, that I could sit up at the desk while the teacher was gone. And the teacher had to tell me, now you're just going to sit here. You don't need to try to run the class or anything, you know.
Right.
Somebody would start acting up and I would be, you know, correcting them and keeping that class in order. So it was really a wonderful experience for me. And I've loved school ever since.
It sounds like it's always been.
I loved it.
It's always
so
been on your spirit.
Storytelling came in. Yeah.
Right. It's always been on your spirit, so much so that
always.
You advocated for yourself at 4 and a half.
That's
I'll
right.
through a tantrum.
That's right. And I mean, I took a risk because, like I said, you didn't do tantrums. My mother didn't have that. But I took a risk because I wanted it so badly that I was just willing to suffer whatever mm-hmm. was going to come.
That's a message
wow,
in itself.
Dedication. So as we mentioned in your bio, you're a guided autobiography facilitator. So can you tell us, what does a guided autobiography facilitator do?
Okay, essentially what we do is provide a safe and supportive space for, and I say ordinary people, because the groups that we put together for classes, there are no requirements. You know, that you don't have to pass a test or you don't have to have any particular degree or background. So ordinary people who want to write their life stories, they have this safe and supportive space. And our job is to inspire them to feel free to share their memories and to recall their memories. We have activities that we give them, and then they recall their memories. They go home the next class. They're usually about 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, depends on the teacher. And they come back with their finished story, minimum of 2 pages. And the only reason we say 2 pages is they're going to read their stories in class. So we don't want them to write, you know, 40 pages and think they can write 40 pages. I always tell them, you can write as much as you like, but we're only going to have time for you to share 2 pages, because they read their story to the group, and then the members of the group give feedback, positive feedback. And that's where the magic takes place. That's what makes it different from a regular class or a regular writing class. Because those students who are, especially ordinary people who don't aspire to be writers, some of them may not have finished college, they are worried how people are going to react to their stories, partly. And when they get that positive feedback from their fellow classmates, and they realize that whatever they thought was a horrible experience or was uncomfortable or whatever, sometimes they realize to other people that was a wonderful experience, or to other people they thought I was really brave. And so they get a different view of themselves and their experiences. And it turns out that they end up loving that class, and they always end up sharing things that they didn't think they would ever share with anybody. So the guided autobiography facilitator has a great job of being a guide, of giving people courage and giving them comfort, keeping the space safe by that, you know, no, everything is confidential. You're not to share this outside of the room. And even pictures, I take pictures to share on my website, but I always ask them to sign an agreement giving me permission. And if someone says they don't want their picture taken, then I don't shoot with them in the shot. And that way everybody stays safe. And they like me. My reviews are, they like me because I'm always joking with them in the class. And it put, you know, humor puts people at ease.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
That's what we do.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
And I also recall,
yeah,
we heard you speak before, and I'm just real quick, Sarah Connor, she spoke before, and the whole thing is just starting. A lot of people think that they have to be a professional or expert. You just start writing,
right,
and the story will come. It'll manifest itself. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sharkana.
No, it's okay. You know, and that kind of touches on another question, too. But before we get to that, why do you think telling, you know, one story is important?
Okay, and I want to add something to what Dennis just said, that they just start writing. The facilitators, we do have carefully selected themes that they write on. So everybody's mm-hmm. writing on the same theme each week. But these are kind of life themes that all of us would be able to write on, like what's a turning point in your life? Everybody can think of something. And we do give them some about 11 or 12 prompts they can pick from. So there is guidance in there, and that makes a big difference, too, because people who aren't used to school settings, you know, feel like they're floundering if you don't give them some kind of a little structure, but not too much.
Yeah.
But why do you think storytelling is important? Well, because storytelling is, first of all, it's the mechanism by which we can access our memories, what things have happened to us. When we begin to tell a story, we are accessing memories to give support for the story. And then I think it's important because it enables us to revisit good times and feel good about things and feel proud of ourselves, and it enables us to visit bad times or times that were full of grief or illness or trauma. And when we revisit those, painful though they may be, we gain a new understanding. And we not only gain a new understanding, we sometimes find solace and even find forgiveness. Forgiveness maybe for ourselves, for our part in whatever. But
powerful.
We get a whole different perspective.
Powerful.
Yes, it's a different perspective. So, and you can do, by the way, you can tell your story at any point in your life. So, and by the way, you can write as many stories or memoirs as you want. There are some authors who, published authors, who write memoirs. They have, one author has written about 18 memoirs.
Wow.
And they are about different phases of her life. And obviously they overlap to some extent because they're all about her life.
Right.
But you don't have to be stuck with one. But I think that and now I just read an article about research of the power of stories. Stories are more powerful than lectures. You know, you ask me for my advice, I can give you a little lecture about what you ought to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if I tell you a story about that thing happening to me or to my children and share with you what I did and how painful it was, how I got out of it, how I dealt with it, that's going to make – that goes to a different part of your brain, as a matter of
fact.
And it helps people a lot because we all want to, that we're not alone in this world. And I don't know why we think that whatever experience we've had, that we're the only one that's had it, but that's the way we think, unfortunately. So when we hear somebody else share something, then we go, in a way we think, oh, good, somebody else had that problem. Oh, good.
Right, it's validating in a way.
It validates.
Right, right.
But more importantly, people who hear our stories, they can be empowered now to explore their experiences and look at their memories, work on their problems. It makes such a difference. And, I mean, it does not have to be much. When I got ready to go back to get my doctorate, I was hemming and hawing about, oh, my goodness, am I going to be able to manage all this? Because I had 2 children, 5 and 3 at the time. No, 5 and 2. And they were engaged, very little ones, okay? And they were engaged in music lessons in church and preschool and all that stuff. And but I had an opportunity to get a grant, and I did not want to pass up getting a grant. So especially because a PhD is something I always wanted. From a little kid, I wanted it, and I didn't even know what it was. But in my church, I knew that my pastor had a doctorate. In those days, the PhD was that they didn't have EdDs and some of the variations they have now. The principal of my high school had a PhD. The superintendent of the district was a black man, had a PhD. So when I asked, what's the highest degree you could get? Because I just wanted to know how to stay in school forever. And they said PhD, and I thought, oh, when I grow up, I'm going to get a PhD. So this was something I always wanted. But I was still thinking, you know, how am I going to manage all this? Well, the violin teacher told me, she said, you should consider talking to one of the parents. She's working on her PhD right now, too. And I said, oh, she is. She said, yeah, talk to her. Maybe she can give you some tips about how, you know, I was worried about managing the time. And so I saw this. I didn't know this parent other than just would see her at lessons. And I saw her headed toward the, leaving the parking lot, headed toward the building where the lessons were held when I was going to take my kids from violin lessons one day. Yes, they were taking violin when they were 5 and 2. And the,
hey,
the lady is walking fast, right? I'm behind her. I'm trying to catch her. And I don't even remember her name. And I just caught up with her and I said, excuse me. And I could tell she was no nonsense. She was trying to get to her kids' lesson. She
right.
didn't have time for chit chat. So I said, excuse me, I just want to ask you a question. And I had to talk fast, you know. And I said, Mrs. Shimizu said that you are in the doctoral program and I'm considering getting in it. Do you have any advice for me? And she said, she turned and looked at me. I guess she must have said, this woman, she says, yes, manage your time. That's what it's all about, managing your time.
Right.
And I said, oh, okay, thank you. Boom, and she was gone. I haven't seen her since. All she needed to do, all I needed to do was to talk to somebody else who was doing what I wanted to do. And
right.
she was almost finished with her degree. And that was enough to encourage me to proceed, that I would be able to do it. And this is why telling your story, telling what you're going through, it's powerful. And
yeah.
you definitely need to
I was just going
to
comment on that, that
doing,
you're probably encouraging
yeah.
so many people right now. So, yeah.
I hope so. If they want to know anything
I mean,
about
as
managing
you were talking
kids
about
and going to school,
memoirs,
talk to me.
Yeah. I was ready. I'm like, I'm going to start writing my story. You know, 18 memoirs from one woman's life. That's, you know, that in of itself
oh, right.
is like inspiring to hear.
It's inspiring. And she's the best. She's a best-selling author and the Mott. But her stories are almost all autobiographical in nature. And one day on Twitter, some guy said, I like her books, but all she does is talk about herself. And I thought, poor guy, he doesn't realize she writes memoirs. That's what
right.
you do. You talk about yourself. It was the funniest thing. But yeah, so the story that you tell is not just for you. It helps you too.
Right.
But it's extremely important
Absolutely.
Because it helps everybody who hears it, whether they know you or not.
Exactly. Well said. Well said.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in talking about writing our stories and sharing our stories, you know, in your experience, what's like common roadblocks that people have when they're trying to tell their story?
And I want to tell you that all of us have roadblocks, even when we have an education, a lot of experience. I had a roadblock in starting my life story, believe it or not, when I retired. 40 years of teaching, PhD, a lot of experience, books, articles, so forth. When I sat down to write my life story the first time, and my daughter had even, oldest daughter had even given me a book that had some prompt questions in there, I answered a few of those, and then I just was frozen. It was like, this just wasn't working for me. Everybody
mm-hmm.
has roadblocks because it's a personal thing, it's your story. And you don't know where to start. And most people think you should start at birth and work your way through to wherever you are. But that's why the guided autobiography method works well, because we don't start like that. So the biggest thing people think is, my life is not interesting. Who wants to read about it? They don't know where to start. Like, I didn't know exactly how to start on mine. Most people are very insecure about their writing skills. They may be
right.
okay writers otherwise, but when it comes to their life stories, they're comparing it in their heads with the published books that are out on the market. Also,
yeah.
people fear hurting they fear hurting the feelings of their family. If they're going to be telling stories about their lives, it's going to obviously involve some other characters in there. They worry about revealing family secrets because we all have those situations where we grew up and you don't air your family dirty laundry,
right.
They used to say.
Mm-hmm.
And we worry about opening all wounds. An example, when I wrote my book, Color Your Life Happy, the first edition, I talk about my life in there. So it's all kind of little episodes and things about my life to support whatever I was saying. But one thing
right.
I didn't go too much into was my separation from my husband. And I kind of just glazed over it. And after I wrote that book and it was out for a little while, I decided that it was not as useful as it could be because I had not gone into that aspect. You know, it's kind of like
right.
you tell the first part and then you just skip over that to the next things that happen. And I said, I've got to rewrite and include that, how we broke up, what happened, what caused it, and also try to tell it in a way that was not making him the villain, but yet
right.
it needed to be told.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
right.
you worry about opening old wounds, and everybody worries about that. But the great thing about the process we use, it helps you get through that. And, you know, once you realize everybody has these various problems. I can't imagine a problem that somebody hasn't had that you think you're the only one in the world who's had that problem. So when you're in a situation where you're sharing with other people, it's not that misery loves company, which, you know, in some cases it might be true, but you love knowing that somebody else had it and they survived. They got through
yeah.
it. And so that roadblock you can throw out. But it's common. That's the first. I was listening to a guy at a luncheon. I met a lady from out of the country, and she invited me to join with her and some of her friends. And this guy worked, they had just retired from Disney. He'd been working there like 30 years. And he found out, you know, she introduced me, and he found out, you know, I help people tell their life stories. The first thing he said was, oh, well, nobody would want to read my story if I told my life story. And I turned to look at him, and before he could finish that sentence, he didn't finish the sentence, he went on and he said, but now if you ask me what it was like working at Disneyland for 30 years, I could talk all day. And I
right.
said to him, great, that's where you would start your story. And he was like, oh.
The
right,
life
exactly,
and times of an
exactly.
employee at Disneyland.
Yeah, and
yeah,
you know,
and,
he could talk about that, sure.
And as you mentioned, you know, he probably, you know, because when I think about writing my own story, you know, I often start with, like, my birth date and when I was a kid, and, you know, likely he was thinking the same thing. And I think when we kind of think we have to start there, and it doesn't necessarily sound, like, super exciting. But, you know, like in this situation, it's like, no, you don't have to start there. You can start somewhere else. So that's really interesting. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to start with our next set of questions. And I have to tell you, I really didn't want to share this, but my phone is buzzing with text messages
uh-oh.
Of how much you are helping people. You have no idea, and I can't wait to share some of the feedback with you. Our next
Thank
question
you.
Is, what? You're welcome. What are some tips to help people get unstuck in the process?
Okay, the first tip I suggest is to get help where you can, because working in isolation is a dream killer for almost everything. So if you have a situation where someone else is writing their story or someone else wants to write their life story, the two of you can agree to be accountability partners and work on it, you know, and make a date each Friday. We'll talk on the phone and see where you are. Of course, I'm going to say join a class like mine, a structured class, but not a writer's critique group. That's very different. Because the writer's critique group are people who are typically going to publish their books. And when you're writing a life story, many times people don't have publishing in mind. And I'll talk a little bit about the difference next. But having some structure and having an experienced person like me who knows what's coming up in terms of how you're feeling and can kind of guide things along makes a difference. The accountability partner makes a difference because they are on the same path. And then the other thing that should, a lot of people get stuck when they are holding back stuff. So if you're writing your story and all kind of horrible things come up in your mind that you want to write, write them. You should write without censoring yourself, because everything you write, you do not have to keep in the book and you don't have to share with anyone. You're writing it, you know, you just spill it out there and say everything and anything you want to say about yourself and tell the truth, because that is something you're not going to have to share if you don't want to. So being free, you know, just giving yourself free rein to write or type, whichever you're doing. And by the way, writing by hand is a lot more powerful, they say, although most of us on the computer these days, there's a different connection going on between your brain and your hands when you write. But yeah, getting unstuck, you want to, and of course there's plenty of books on the market and there are YouTube channels and all kinds of ways of getting unstuck. But being with someone who's working on the same thing you're working on, the type of thing, or having someone who is going to give you guidance, that makes a big difference.
Right, and inspires you. Our next question is, when should one consider publishing?
Okay, publishing, remember, is a business. So if you mean by publishing that you want your book to be available on Amazon for anyone to purchase, then you have to make a decision. Are you ready to go to an established publisher, Random House or somebody? And if so, are you ready to release control of your book? Because when you go to a publisher, established publisher, they are in the business of making money, and they make their money from selling books. And they sell the books that people want to read. So they're very much concerned about the trends. They're concerned about, will this appeal to the public? Right now, for a long time, memoirs have been very popular. So if you wrote a memoir that is about overcoming drug addiction, it better be very unique if you expect it to sell and become a bestseller, because there have been a lot of books written about addiction. So if you want to publish it, you've got to be aware that you're having to appeal to different things. If you're writing it for yourself mainly, you could still publish it. But then if you're self-publishing, for example, which means you're doing the same job that Random House is doing, except you're in control because you are having to pay for every service that you have to hire. If you go to a publisher, established publisher, they give you, you know, they're taking care of all the expenses, but they also have the control. But some people want to put their books on for sale, but they don't care if it becomes a bestseller. If that's your attitude and you can hold to that and you're not going to be crying about you didn't make any sales, then it's okay to publish. But just be aware that when you publish, meaning put your book up for sale, you typically are trying to appeal to the public, and there's certain things that you're going to want to be concerned about, like the book cover and a number of things. If you are writing for your family mainly, and you type it up and you staple it together and you pass out copies to your family at the next reunion, then in a way that's publishing in some sense, because you're distributing it. But you're not trying to please a public, and you're not having to answer to anyone, and you're not going after bestseller status. So I say when you're ready to completely relinquish control over your story, then an established publisher is a good way to go. If you want it published but you want to keep control, then you need to go self-published, and that means there's a lot that you have to learn about that industry, because you're essentially not doing it yourself. You're running things yourself. That's what self-publishing means. And if you're going to make it available to the public, there are things you've got to be concerned about that maybe you wouldn't be before, like hurting somebody's feelings in your family. That may be something you would want to think about. Or calling out somebody who's famous, and you may want to be concerned about the liability and things of that nature. So publishing puts you in a little different place, but that's not to say it's not a good thing. to do, but you just need to be aware of that. I do talk about that in my guided autobiography class. And matter of fact, I made a product that talks about seven ways to share your life story with people. And it goes all the way from stapling it together all the way to how to publish it and make it available on Amazon. And I talk about, you know, those different ways in between. So you can do it. And if you feel like you have a compelling story that needs to be shared with the world, then by all means. But it really helps if you know that you want to do that from the beginning, because then you can start off a little different way than
right,
you would
you're more
if you
focused
weren't going to publish
and you have a target.
Right.
Our next question is, what are some of your favorite autobiographies? One or two, please.
Okay, just two. and by the way, I used to differentiate between autobiography, which means from birth to a complete life review, and memoir, where you can just focus on an aspect of your life. My two favorites right now are Trevor Noah's Born a Crime, and he's a South African comedian who came to America and won the position of the host of The Daily Show, which had been Jon Stewart for many years. His Born a Crime is a wonderful memoir about South Africa. It gives you a glimpse of South Africa growing up there and what he went through, and then his view of, you know, America. Then the other one is Angelus Ashes, which is by an author named Frank McCourt, and it's about his growing up in Ireland and about the poverty and the painful family dynamics he went through, and yet some of the high points that he is fond of. So both of those are excellent memoirs / autobiographies. Frank McCourt's is definitely more of a memoir. Trevor Noah's is sort of kind of in the autobiography realm, but he's young still, so, you know, it doesn't cover, you know, decades and decades. But both of those are good. And, of course, there are many, 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 you know, Maya Angelou's Caged Bird, and all of those are great books for people to read. And I'm glad you mentioned, I advise people to read a couple of memoirs when they're getting ready to start their story, even no matter whether you want to publish it or not, just to feel the flow of writing when you're talking about, you know, just see the rhythm and the flow of it. It's not that you're plagiarizing or copying. You just get the flow of it. So those are my two favorites right now.
Awesome. How can people find out more about you or your work? Or if they
want
to work
simple.
With you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm trying to keep it simple in my life these days. FloraBrown.com. That's it. You go to my website, and anything that I'm doing will be mentioned there somehow or another. I have a free download I'd like people to get called 7 Reasons You Have Trouble Writing Your Life Story, but it'll be on the little bar of links that are near the top, and it says Trouble Writing Your Life Story, and you click on that and you'll sign up for a download, or you can go all the way to the bottom of the page, and I have a bigger announcement about that book, but that's a good one to read because it'll kind of hit on the things we've just talked about. So that's the main place to go. I'm active in social media and all those places, but you'll find out about those over on FloraBrown.com.
If they go to the website, awesome. And carrying on Bernice Bennett's tradition with her guest, Flora, what are some parting words that you would like to share with our listeners?
I would like to ask people to imagine if you found your great-great-great-grandfather's journal or life story that he wrote, and in it he shares his feelings, his fears, his pains, his regrets, how he fell in love with his wife, where he married her, day-to-day living he went through, all of those things. Boy, wouldn't you be happy to find that from all those generations ago? So if you feel that way, think about the power you have currently to prevent your loved ones from regretting that you didn't write your life story.
Write your
life story, because we will definitely not be here, no matter how great well we take care of ourselves, several generations down the line. The only way our loved ones will know about us will be the stories we left behind. Yeah, they'll have the pictures, they'll have our certificates, they'll have our war medals or whatever, but the story is very different. And you don't have to be a writer. You just have to be you in your voice, your style, misspellings and all. The stories about you and your remembered experiences. So I urge everyone to please avoid having your family have a regret about not knowing you by writing your story, and I promise you it will become a treasured part of your legacy.
That's wow, that is so powerful. Dr. Brown, thank you for being our guest this evening and for encouraging our listeners to write and share their family stories. Before we close, I just want to say I was just inspired and encouraged, and I want people to be able to support you and start writing. So if folks head over to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana on Facebook, and if you share just start writing one or two paragraphs, Sharicana and I will select three winners, to receive all of Flora Brown's products. How about that? We'll support you. We'll support you. You've been so supportive of us, and we'll support you and encourage our guests or listeners to write. And so we'll close with that. But again, go over to our Facebook page, Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Sharicana. You have, let's say, until tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. to submit your story. Just post a paragraph on our Facebook page, and we'll select a winner. Please do that by 9 p.m. tomorrow night. To our guests, Sharicana and I look forward to sharing with you next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. This has been amazing. Thank you so much, Dr. Flora Brown.
See you all next Thursday. Everybody have a great
night.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.